Welcome to our third episode of the Foresight Active Advantage podcast series. Today, I have a very special guest join me, Dan Barker, Portfolio Manager at Apus Capital. Apus Capital is a hedge fund based in the US. They manage both long, short, and long only small and mid cap global equity strategies. Dan is a 30-year veteran of the markets, having invested across a number of roles and spent 20 years with Apus Capital. So Dan's here today to talk all things global equities, small and mid-cap with us on the podcast. Dan, welcome to the Foresight Active Advantage podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You were saying offline that it's starting to get quite cold in the US today.
Well, I'm based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it's cold. It's about, I think you guys can think in Fahrenheit. It's about 20 degrees, and I think we had about an inch of snow today, so it's getting whitened up for Christmas. And, of course, it's very dark this time of year. The sun sets around 4:30, so it's kind of a period of time in Minnesota where everybody works really hard because there isn't a whole lot else to do. And then when spring comes, there's a lot of Scandinavians in Minnesota, so they sort of, tear off their clothes and jump in the lake when it gets to be about 60 degrees out. So it's an interesting and, part of what makes it interesting is the weather, because it's highly, it's a continental climate. So it's pretty hot in the summer and very cold in the winter.
Now, Minnesota is not exactly known as being an investment center. How did you come to work with Apus in Minnesota?
Well, I did spend 20 years in sort of New York, and I guess I'm from the Midwest originally, and born and raised in Minneapolis, and went to school at Wisconsin. And my first job out of school was on the East Coast in D.C. Actually, an operations finance role at General Electric, but pretty quickly worked for GE in their pension fund, and that was based in New York and London. So I spent about 5 years in London. Maybe 5 years in sort of the New York area initially, and then back to New York after London for another 10 years or so before deciding, kind of from a lifestyle standpoint, some personal things in my own family, and my mother was ill, and some of the things which got me back to wanting to come back to Minneapolis. Plus, my kids were kind of at an age where about to go into high school, and it just sort of fit from a personal lifestyle choice to go back at that time. So, plus, what we do is very global. There isn't actually, New York isn't the center of the universe for small cap, stocks around the world. You can make the phone calls from Minneapolis. We have a good airport to get to Asia or Europe as is required. So you can do this job from just about anywhere. And in a way, we were well prepared because New York, we are still split between New York and Minneapolis as a firm. And we've been that way for the last 5 or 6 years. So, in terms of COVID and some of the changes in work, we were pretty well placed. We were already kind of doing video calls and things like this. And so it was a relatively smooth transition.
So you were Zooming before it was even a thing.
Yeah. It was Skype. We did Skype video. But Zoom and Teams is sort of where we live now, as everyone does, I guess.
Great. So tell us a bit about Apus, its beginning and when you joined and what you set out to do when you helped start the firm.
Yeah, it was kind of born out of our experience as mutual fund managers and sort of long-only managers. I had always had the ambition, I guess, to do something like that, to have my own investment firm. To be honest, I just never had the people, never had, maybe the self-confidence to just go off on my own and get a headhunter and hire a few analysts. I wanted to have, obviously good people, honest people, but people that, I believed were moneymakers and that, would do a good job. And so I had a lot of offers over my time at GE or at J&W Seligman, which is where I had my second, stint. I think we just had a really good group of people, number one. There was also some factors at the time. The firm I worked for was very long into tech. They had grown and through the technology bubble of the 2000 period. had kind of exploded. And then obviously we all know what happened. The tech bubble imploded. Now, we were just sort of this little odd group in the corner doing international and global bonds. I ran an emerging market fund as well as a global small cap fund. But the firm was having its issues. And so I don't want to say, there was no great opportunity cost, let's say, to leaving. But I said, just as importantly, was really just the opportunity to have, really good people. And, we thought a really, kind of, again, born out of that long only experience. What we saw is sort of an opportunity to make what we thought was, kind of an idyllic product, a product that would really leverage and kind of have this flexibility to go wherever the research took us globally. We were, comfortable with investing. Actually, the one place we didn't have a lot of experience investing, ironically, was the United States. But that was easy. We'd always invested internationally. And what we kept finding all the time was that we'd learn something in one place that would help us understand something else somewhere else. But because of our mandate, we were restricted. If it was a small cap fund and you're doing work on a small cap company and you learn something that gives you an edge in a large cap company, you can't invest in that. You've got to stay in your box, stay in your lane and invest in small cap stocks. Or just the same in emerging markets, you'd maybe find a company in India, and because of that, you're doing all your work surrounding that Indian company, you go, wow, I've just learned something about this U.S. company, and it's given me a real advantage in understanding that U.S. company that U.S. people don't see or appreciate because they're not looking at India. And yet, what can I do with that? I'm an emerging market investor. So, it was very frustrating at times. We'd say, wait a minute, I have this huge, information advantage, which I've generated because I'm thinking about things globally. But because I'm boxed into this emerging market fund and only paid to invest in emerging market companies, I'm kind of stuck there. And I've got to just kind of, I could go to my colleagues across the hallway and say, hey, you guys, this is a really interesting opportunity for your U.S. funds. You should take a look at this, and here's why. But there was no way to express that ourselves. So for us, it was just this really, exciting opportunity to just go wherever the research takes you, go wherever you get the most leverage to your research. Who cares where the headquarters is? Let's just focus on these global situations where we can bring that global perspective and take advantage of that global perspective. So that was the kind of inspiration, I guess, for starting APIS.
Okay. So there's this global perspective sounds like it's a key part of your investment philosophy, being able to look across markets to see companies either in the same industry or in different parts of the value chain within an industry vertical and use those insights. Are there any other key points to your investment philosophy that you think are worth highlighting?
I think the other ambition we had was to create, especially in hedge funds, was to have a product where we could put, our entire net worth invested into it and not really worry about market direction. I think, we had felt, and certainly in a long enough time frame, you could put your entire net worth in a long-only emerging market fund and probably do just fine. But would you generally want to do that? Maybe not. And so this opportunity to kind of create products that were generally low net, that our flagship fund is maybe runs, 40 to 60% net, and maybe the deep value fund runs a little bit longer than, maybe a little 50% type net or 60% net. But to have a structure where, we could make money long, make money short, and have, not be slaves necessarily to market direction or be terribly worried, and something that would, stock picking, which is what we said we would be good at, drive most of what you get. Clearly, we're going to be impacted by market direction. There's no way around it. But to be able to kind of mute that somewhat and let stock picking really drive your returns was kind of the other, main ambition of launching these products. And we have, we eat our own cooking. We're invested, I'm outside of my home or car. All my net worth is in our three products.
That's something that's important, and I hear that quite often when I talk to fund managers like you that have gone on to set up their own business after having worked for a larger firm, is that there's very much this focus on, all right, well, now I'm doing it and I'm going to take everything that I've learned, the good and the bad from working in a larger firm, and I'm going to build something that I feel comfortable putting, having a lot of skin in the game in skin in the game, whether it be reputationally, but also investing your own assets into. And that seems to be a key driver across a lot of boutique fund managers that I talk to. I think it feeds into results too.
Yeah, I think the other thing you have to understand when you have a small investment firm is it's really just a small business too. And, you know, there's a lot of aspects to, you know, as I kind of developed myself, I was a GE, I had the luxury of just kind of being an analyst, being a portfolio manager, not having to worry about a lot of admin, although there's politics everywhere. And then you move into a more senior role at another company. And of course, you need to hire people and you need to do more marketing and put yourself out there. And so as you develop those skills, and I think too, just kind of seeing GE, which had, you know, strengths as a firm and an operation, and J&W Seligman, which had its own strengths and weaknesses as a firm. And you kind of learn, you see contrasts in, you know, different businesses, and you kind of say, you know, I can do this. It's all kind of about building that confidence in yourself that, yeah, I can be a good investor, but I also won't be overwhelmed by the operational task, which is also pretty significant. And you know, what is at the bottom of at the end of the day, just a small business.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned very briefly in your answer that you have the two long short funds, one's deep value, and now a long only fund. Can you give us a brief summary of the similarities and differences between the three funds?
Yeah, absolutely. They're all very much related, and you know, I sometimes regret. You know, we sometimes regret the name deep value for the second fund, because it really is the small cap version of our flagship strategy. And our flagship strategy, again, from a U.S. person's perspective, is still a small cap strategy. The sweet spot there is probably a $1 to $5 billion type company. So, you know, it's many people will consider that small cap, but that is a product that we could scale that, you know, we thought, you know, could be a $1 billion type fund. But what we kept running into were things that were really small. You know, it might be a $200 million company and it's half owned by the family and trades by appointment. And, you know, but damn, it's cheap, you know, but these aren't cigar butts. These are good businesses. These are compounding businesses. They have good growth prospects, but they're also extremely cheap. You know, it was not uncommon to find things that were 2, 3, 4 times earnings. They were 15, 20% growers. And we really couldn't do that in the flagship strategy because of risk management, because of, you know, we wanted to scale, and just the market cap and liquidity kind of kept us from those types of names. But gosh, you can't stop us. If you see something like that, you want to do the work. You got to get the family on the phone and try to understand this business. And so it was really just an outlet for us to be able to do those kinds of things and kind of take an owner's approach to investing, not be as worried about, you know, catalysts and, you know, getting paid near term, but just saying, look, this is going to be worth a lot more at some point in the future. And so, you know, we may get stuck in this name. We may be, you know, like I say, have to act like owners rather than investors. But it was really just an outlet to be able to still have that fun and do those kinds of situations that we'd come across. And so that product does not scale. It's about $110 million product today. And we think it could be a $200 million product, but we'd close the fund. It isn't, you know, commercially, it's not a great product, but we still have fun, and it does give us a place to kind of scratch that itch when we see something that's really small. But in terms of valuation, in terms of the types of companies that we're looking for, that's really the same. You know, it's just that typically because they're so small and maybe so obscure that they're even cheaper, but the growth characteristics are, you know, should be there as well. As far as the long only product, that's really just a carve out of what we're doing on the long side of the hedge funds. You know, we have a really strong track record and on the long side and a good track record on the short side, but we've had people come just from a business, again, kind of business development standpoint. You get to talk to a different audience when you talk about long only. There's sort of a, you know, there's a portion of the allocators who look for alternatives, and maybe, you know, 10% of their pie is in alternatives and 30% of that is equity long short. You know, you're down to like 3% of their pie, you know, that you're fighting for. Whereas maybe half the pie is long equities. You know, people tend to look at long equities, and it tends to be, you know, institutional type money. And so we have a great track record on the long side, and it's probably a shame we didn't start it sooner. But as of 2000, we started the Lonely, what we call the Global Discovery Fund, which focuses on a subset of the long ideas within the two strategies. The overlap is, 95%. It's all the same names with a few exceptions, and we can get into that later. But really, with some of the differences, there's a little room for speculation, I'll say, within the hedge funds. There's some names we do that, we're the same throughout the funds. We're looking for great businesses that can compound over many years. But there's a small part of the hedge funds where, let's say, 5-10%, where we're, I consider speculation anything that doesn't make money, at least today. Obviously we think they're going to make money in the future. We're looking for companies that are really proven compounders, companies that are already generating, positive cash flow for shareholders, that are a little bit more mature for the long only product. We don't really, if one of those speculations works out and it starts to be a good long-term sound compounding business, then it can graduate. The other thing is we've tried to really not sell a great business in the long only product. There are businesses, I think one of our lessons learned, we call it don't cut your flowers in the bloom. It's, time and time again, one of our great weaknesses is selling a great business and watching it double, triple, whatever.
I'm going to ask you for an example now.
There's too many to cite. But with the long only product, we're really trying, we may cut that position dramatically, but we really want to keep, if the business is working, if the market is still a good market and the company is still executing within that market, kind of irrespective of valuation, we want to keep it on the sheet and just let it, you and I both know the secret to success is to just find a great business and never sell it. And if you can do that, which is really hard to do because, you're getting bombarded all the time and it's human nature to keep looking for that next thing. But, the people who have that discipline, we want to have that discipline. I want to grow that discipline within myself and I want that to be a part of the long only fund to just kind of hang on to those great companies almost no matter what. Although, like I say, we'll certainly reduce the position size if it's just on an extreme end of valuation.
I think we've just uncovered another investment edge. So the first one was taking that global perspective. Now we've got a patience and a long-term investment horizon. Are there any other edges that you think you have up your sleeve?
Well, I think certainly, there aren't many people who've been doing international for 30 years. And so a big part of the edge, if you want to call it that, is just I put it in the large bucket of experience. It's experience in terms of understanding differences across borders, accounting differences or how people, different nuances to maybe how people value stocks in different markets. It's experience in terms of having a network of people. We have all kinds of friends all over the world that's been built over, decades that can give us access to companies and help us get in touch with these small businesses and do the translation or set up the meetings or help us with travel if we happen to go to these countries and do things like that. So that network would take a long, long time to build. I think it's experience too, just in terms of having good process, having been through a lot, we've seen, all kinds of risk on, 30 years. Especially as an emerging market investor and, I've seen a lot in my life and hopefully we've taken something from that, to make us better, to make us manage risk better, to make us understand and kind of keep those event risks in perspective, to have, good process for how we diligence companies, how we build portfolios. So I think, it's experience. And then I think the other advantage that we have is just the sandbox that we play in. It's small cap companies and genuinely small. And so I think I think there's a lot of dynamism. There's a lot of interesting businesses that are out there. And that's number one. And number two, there just aren't a lot of people looking at it. We just don't run into, institutional investors. There just aren't that many who do what we do. And so I think when companies get to be kind of, $800 or $1 billion, then you start to get more eyes on them. You start to get more maybe sell side coverage or institutional, the really big institutions, it just doesn't move the needle for them. to look at a $300 million company that maybe they could buy a few million dollars, you know, if they try really hard. So for us, that moves the needle, and so we're good with looking at businesses like that, and I think just other institutional investors just don't care. You know, it's not a real scalable business, you know, and I think that's when you get to the, you know, you put all this time and effort into it, and at the end of the day, you know, you can only be so big with the strategy that we have and be effective with the strategy, and so it doesn't. You know, it pays fine. You know, if you do a good job, you certainly can do well. But it's not in terms of institutional scale. I think you can understand why, you know, Fidelity or some large fund management group just isn't gonna spend a lot of time in the space that we're in. And that's great for us. And I think the other thing too is our competition, if it isn't other institutional investors, it's a lot of retail investors. I think we have a behavioral advantage too. I mean, certainly we have that advantage where we have this global perspective and hopefully, you know, we see things that they don't pick up on. But I think too, you know, when you're up against retail investors, they tend to be kind of, you know, and I respect everyone in the market but you do see when in these risk off events, for example, you'll see sheer panic, you know, and you'll see volatility that, you know, of course you're going to see volatility even in large cap stocks from time to time, but in small caps, it's usually a higher beta market. And a lot of that is retail driven and they're very short term orientated. They may be, you know, investing on the basis of, you know, memes or candlestick charts or, you know, whatever they do, and that's what you're up against, which is okay for me. Cause I think, again, with that 3 to 5 year view or longer term view and having, you know, do a good fundamental work, we can take advantage of that volatility.
I've noticed a few times in our discussion, you've used the word compounder. How would you describe what a compounding business is for you? What are you looking for?
You know, I think we try to keep it simple. I do think people overthink this process and stock picking. And I always say that all you really need to know about a business is a dominant position in a growing market. If you have those two things, that's kind of all you need. You know, if you think of yourself personally, I have no idea what's in your own portfolio, but I would imagine if you have a successful business that you've owned for many, many years, I would think if you thought about the market they're in, it's probably an attractive market that has good growth characteristics. And two, you know, that company is very strongly positioned within that market. And of course, you know, it isn't just that simple. You need to, you know, it implies barriers to entry. It implies that moat. It implies, you know, maybe proprietary products or patents or good management. And you need to check all those boxes. It isn't just, you know, sort of that simple. But if you think of what we're looking for in terms of those compounders, it's that sort of dominant position in a growing market. And, on the flip side, on the short side, you know, where companies are losing a dominant position. If you think of, you know, Intel or something like that, it's not a stock we would really look at, but there was a day, you know, Intel had a dominant position in CPUs and they were selling into PCs, which was a growth market. There was a time where, you know, PCs weren't such a growth market anymore and Intel was no longer such a dominant company either. And so, you know, that might have been something that would get you going on the short side on Intel if you sort of saw that developing within their market. You know, again, and people think, well, small cap companies, how do you have a dominant position? You know, these are small companies. Well, we find, you know, niche companies that have, you know, real IP, real leading shares, you know, oftentimes 50, 60, 70, 80% market share in what they do. It's just an incredibly small niche, which, you know, in our assessment would be a growth area as well. Where we can find companies like that. So those are the types of compounders that we're trying to find. And like I say, you have to be vigilant. You have to make sure that market is still healthy and growing, and that you know, the business that they're going to continue to execute within that market and maintain their, or even hopefully grow their market share.
Do you find that the types of franchises or moats that you were looking for have shifted over time? For example, a lot of investors follow Warren Buffett, and he obviously popularized the idea of moats and talked about a lot of companies that had these great enduring moats. For example, consumer goods companies that were able to get a very strong brand position, and then because once they get that position in a supermarket, it's very hard for another consumer good product to take that position off them. Are those sorts of moats still around, or are moats now shifting more towards technology and other areas that give companies a sustainable competitive advantage?
Yeah, it's a tough question whether, you know, moats are easier or harder than they used to be. I agree with the premise of your question, and looking at something like consumer branded products, I think those moats have eroded a lot. I think consumers are willing to try other products and they might not even go to the grocery store or look at what's at the end cap of the grocery store shelf anymore. So that doesn't buy you anything. But we see a lot of companies that, especially, it's quite often in Asia where maybe they had a legacy business where they did, textiles, or maybe they had a legacy business where they were in, rubber or something, some commodity product. But because they're in Japan or because they're in Taiwan, well, they could no longer compete, making commodity rubber. So they found new applications for their rubber. Maybe it was in, the medical field, or maybe it was in, EV batteries or things like that, where a lot of you've seen a lot of electrical, you're talking about technology, where suddenly they've kind of grown these businesses, and they had this traditional business that sort of melted into the background, and they've gone to these sort of higher end niche components born out of the chemistry they were doing 50 years ago. Where now they have very, very high market share for real specialty niche, compounds that might be a component of an EV battery, or it might be a copper foil that's sitting inside a iPhone or something like that. And they have, literally dominant share. It's just because of, what they were. And so the moats are still really strong because they have relationships. And then again, that chemistry, that initial chemistry was done 40, 50 years ago. And it's just evolved over time. And it's kind of in the woodwork of these businesses. It's kind of in the walls. And you couldn't just sort of snap your fingers and throw a lot of money at it and say, let's, and you might not be that interested in it anyway, because it might be a market that has a total size of a few hundred million dollars or something like that. It wouldn't justify the investment, at least not yet. So we find a lot of those, we have a lot of fun with those types of businesses, and they are quite common in Japan. They're quite common in Taiwan and Korea, where you see they've kind of evolved into something that's becoming very high end. Another business, I don't want to get into too many examples, but there was a company called Eclat Textile in Taiwan, which we don't own today, but it was a company, it was a textile business. And, that textiles got hollowed out by China and Vietnam and, places like that. But so they came up with higher value. I mean, I don't know if you have Lululemon in Australia, but there's sort of this athleisure wear trend. It's been around for a long time. I know my wife likes it and spends too much money there. But when you looked at it, Eclat Textile, what they had this product called Nylon 66, which was a key raw material, which was being sold to Lululemon. And we did the work. There are only three companies in the world that can make this. And we look at a Lululemon at Apus Capital and we say, that just goes in the too hard pile. It's a good business for sure. It's quite expensive. A lot of smart people looking at it. Smart people think it's a long term, smart people that think it's a short. Here's a supplier who, 15% of their sales are to Lululemon, but it's also, 15-20% to Nike and Under Armour and Athleta. And this trend of athleisure wear, that's what we kind of bought into. That was the growth market. But so they had a dominant position. They had more than 50% share for this key raw material that everybody who wanted to make athleisure wear, this sportswear, had to go to Eclat Textile. And here it's 10 times earnings. It has a 6% yield. It's growing 30%. It's supplying everybody. And that's what we do at Apis. It's just sort of, okay, I see this trend and I like, you know, I believe in Lululemon as a business, maybe. But is there a better way to play it in Taiwan? And so that, you know, that was a case where we said, I can get the same growth. And again, in that particular situation, the people in Taiwan had never heard of Lululemon, you know, so it's a small cap company. They didn't understand sort of maybe what the potential was there. And so that's kind of what we're doing all the time, is looking for these niche companies that have reinvented, you know, that's one of the things we do, I guess, where they kind of took an old textile business that was, you know, very, you know, mundane for many, many years, but they went higher and higher value add to create products that people like Lululemon wanted to buy. And you know, they had a great growth that came from that. So it's those kind of things that we see a lot of.
So the moats are still there, but they require a little bit of extra digging maybe to find.
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, we very common for us to kind of look at, you know, I think Apple is an interesting company, or I think Tesla is an interesting company, but we're looking at the supply chain for those companies. You know, it's all those sort of small companies that are maybe have a good, I don't know, you know, lens material for the camera that's on the phone, or some kind of, you know, particular multi-layer ceramic capacitor, which is being used in the next generation of iPhone. And then maybe that little Japanese company has, you know, won the entire share of that. So it's those kind of things that, again, these little niches that you could find, you know, usually cheap companies, you know, that might not be appreciated for what it is. And, you know, they have really good growth prospects because of, you know, what we sense is this, the supply chain and the product, I guess, life cycle of some of the new products, maybe that Apple's coming out with or Tesla or what have you.
Do you find that these sorts of companies, do you find them more frequently in certain industry sectors?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when you look at what we do and don't do within global investing, we're really not interested in things that are local. So if you need, you know, if you think of industries like property stocks in Tokyo or Hong Kong or a construction business or a business that's like a utility, or where you've got, you know, you got to know the politicians and you got to know the regulators, we avoid that. We don't know anything about Japanese property. And you should, you know, if you want to invest in Japan and have somebody who's a Japan expert, you know, they should be on the ground in Japan, you know, that's their edge, you know, they would have that advantage. But sectors like technology is clearly, you know, a sector where a global perspective is required. Healthcare is another area where we see a lot of situations where a global perspective is really helpful. You know, consumer names like Ecot Textile, for example, you know, is another area where, you know, global companies competing on a global basis. And in an industrial and materials, you know, commodity type businesses or industrial type businesses, to me, any business that sells to another business is sort of an industrial business. And so, again, those are definitely fair games. So there's those sectors that lend themselves to a global approach. And then I would also say there's those geographies that lend themselves to a global approach. You don't really find us in frontier markets. You know, we're not, again, I think if you're going to buy a stock in Africa, you know, you probably got to get the country factor is the dominant factor, right? If you pick, can't really pick stocks in Egypt, I think you're either going to get Egypt right or wrong. But there are countries that are very global. You know, Korea is clearly export orientated. You know, it's perfect for what we do. Taiwan is perfect for what we do. Japan is perfect for what we do. You know, companies and I should say countries which have, you know, deeper markets, a lot of export oriented companies. If you look at an India, it might be, you know, IT services, or again, it could be healthcare. There's also a lot of good industrial exporting companies within India as well. But generally it's North America, it's Europe, it's, you know, it's Japan. You know, those are the big areas. But where you find us in emerging markets, it's not, you know, not going to be the Africas. It's not really the Latin. Again, never say never. We're free to go wherever we want. That's all part of the strategy. But Latin America, again, you know, Russia, Eastern Europe doesn't feature terribly high in our list. So there are countries that lend themselves to that global approach, I would say, and also sectors that that we gravitate towards.
So we've spoken a little bit about stock picking on the long side. How does your approach differ on the short side? What are you looking for there?
You know, to some degree, I'd start with and say that you can first think of it as sort of the opposite of long. You know, I mentioned dominating positions in growing markets. Well, if a company is losing its dominating position or its market is going X growth, you know, those are good places to start in terms of you know, looking at the short side. You know, I think we're, you know, I would say there's so many lessons learned from short selling over 20 years. And I think when we first came to this business of running a hedge fund, it was like, oh, sure, you know, you can't short sell. You're not going to know how to short sell. And certainly, you know, I think, well, we're always learning in this business. And so, you know, but certainly we learned some fast lessons, you know, within shorting. And then there's been sort of ongoing lessons within shorting. But I would say, you know, whereas valuation is important to us on the long side, it's pretty far down the list on the short side. It's not something that we start with. Matter of fact, ironically, some of the best places to look for shorts is the cheapest, highest yielding stocks you'll find. And you say, well, why would you start there? I mean, it's usually there's a signal that there's a problem, you know, that sometimes it's cheap for a reason. And, you know, whereas I think that some people might, you know, it's understandable why you'd look at expensive stocks to potentially short. I say been there, done that. You know, it doesn't, at least for us, it didn't work that well. it's not a bad thing if you have all the other things stars aligned and it's expensive. Then you know that's a good thing. But we definitely don't start with that. And like I say, almost the opposite. We look for cheap stocks to short, which sounds silly, but it could be a sign of stress. You know, risk management is also, you know, very different. You risk manage naturally as a long investor. You know, I say a good stock that works gets bigger, a stock that fails you gets smaller by its nature. On the short side, when you're wrong, they get bigger. And so you have to risk manage, you know, differently on the short side. And also, you know, when you get one right on the short side, for example, there's a whole host of behavioral aspects to investing generally, obviously, but I think even, you know, more, mind torture goes on the short side. And you know, oftentimes you're in this battle with a short, you know, you maybe have spent a very long period of time and done a lot of work, and finally your ship comes in and you've got a 1% position that goes down 20% because, hey, they missed earnings or something bad happened and your thesis is finally getting recognized. You know, it's human nature to just almost say like, oh, thank God, you know, like I'm out of here, you know, or to not add to that position. You know, I mean, really when you get it right, and again, this is sort of lessons learned after years, now it's going the right direction. You know, people are beginning to recognize and maybe see what you've seen all along. You've got to power in. You know, you've got to take, you know, what was hopefully a small short position that was a battleground for a period of time and now make it real, you know, which for us is still a relatively small position, but, you know, maybe a 1% to 2% type position where we have high conviction. Whereas we, you know, we do position size significantly larger on the long side. So, you know, but we look for the same things. It's competitive threats. It's frauds and fads. It's you know, secular. We call them melting ice cubes. You know, but we've done a lot over the years to kind of like improve our process and take those lessons learned and try to get better at short selling. And I think the other thing, you know, you talked about advantages we have early, you know, I think, where do you find the frauds in the world? You know, where do you find the bad actors in the world? It's not typically at, you know, 3M or you know, name your large cap, high quality, you know, good, generally good business. It's usually in these small businesses. You know, there's a lot of flaky characters. There's a lot of bad actors, but they're $200 million companies or $300 million companies. These pump and dumps, you know, these, you've seen all the fraud in China and places like that. It, you know, again, those things don't really move the needle for a lot of other funds. They don't even really bother to look. But for us, again, we can look at some really small companies. And so, that I think that plays to our advantage as well.
It sounds like the niche that you occupy just helps you to avoid a bit of that competition from larger institutional investors. You sort of occupy a space just beneath where they're forced to invest by a sheer dint of the assets that they manage. And so you've almost got first pick of what happens beneath that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, right? Especially, I mean, the magic happens in small cap when, you know, you get a good compounding business and then eventually the re-rating comes. And that when it's compounding and it's cheap and then, you know, you get discovery, that's where you get, you know, the quote unquote multi-baggers. And so, that's the other, you know, virtue. Of course, you have to, you know, small cap is not easy and you have to be pragmatic and they're not all going to be the next Apple. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. almost none of them are going to be the next Apple. And so, you know, it's hard work, but when they do come in, you know, you can definitely, you know, get one or two ideas, which can make up for a lot of mistakes.
Are your shorts usually paired with a long, or are they standalone positions?
They're really standalone positions. I mean, there have been a few cases where we've had genuine winners and losers. And so we're going to buy the winner and sell a loser, but we're looking to make money, not just hedge. We want, you know, idiosyncratic ideas that stand on their own. We will, if we have a lot of, you know, and really that's also a lesson learned. I mean, when we were young, we would, you know, maybe force a short. If we had a lot of great ideas in Korea, but we didn't want a lot of Korea exposure, you know, we'd look for things on the short side. You know, again, we were looking for fundamental shorts, but I suppose we compromised on our principles somewhat to kind of force something that was not necessarily optimal. Today, you know, we just learned to manage that through the long side. If we can't find, you know, if we're not comfortable with career risk or what have you, we just won't, you know, we may have a great idea and we maybe in a normal circumstance that have a much bigger long position, but because of that career risk, you know, we'll just dial that down and not have as much. If we can't find, you know, good high quality shorts in Korea that stand on their own, we'll just manage that career risk through the long side.
Okay. Perhaps you can take us through an investment idea from start, the initial idea generation, through to implementation in the portfolio. Give our listeners an idea of how that whole process works from start to finish.
Sure. Maybe one that's a bit of a sort of a growth cyclical. We had a position in Siltronic, and of course, everybody wants to talk about their winners. So I'll give you a winner. But you know, I caution you. There have been many losers over the years. But one business, a German company called Siltronic, was very good to us, I think, about 3 years ago, and it was a perfect kind of setup for Apis. It was spun out of a German chemical company called Wacker Chemie, and it was a company that makes silicon wafers. So, you know, they compete with Global Wafers. They compete with MEMC, which is now part of Global Wafers, Sumco, Shin-Etsu, LG, Siltron. So we know the semiconductor wafer space really well, and we've invested in that space. You know, it's cyclical, but, you know, it has its moments. It's having one of its moments now. It's a very attractive sector. And these are making the raw wafers, the 6-inch, the 8-inch, the 12-inch wafers that are used to fabricate, you know, circuits. Semiconductors. And Siltronic is, you know, a 15% type player, I would say, you know, maybe in that 15 to 20% of the global market. The Japanese are very strong. There's, like I say, a couple Taiwanese that are strong, but it's a nice oligopoly. Like I say, 5-6 main players. And when Siltronic was spun out of Wacker, you know, it's the only semiconductor wafer company in Europe. And, it was covered initially by German chemicals analysts because, you know, they covered Wacker. And so this thing came public and you know, we were watching the semiconductor cycle get much healthier. And we had a kind of feel for how strong the earnings power can be in an up cycle for this sector. And so we did our work on Siltronic, and you know, we came up with our numbers, and I think it was a 40 euro stock, and you know, we had them earning about 9 euros of earnings. And when we looked at the street, you know, which was, like I say, a couple of German analysts who cover chemicals, they had 4 as the earnings, you know, so they had it on 10 times earnings and we had it on, you know, less than 4 times earnings. Now in the end, we were wrong. It was actually, they made about 12 that year. So we were too low. You know, it was really on less than, you know, 3 or about 3 times earnings, I guess. But the whole point of that discussion was that, you know, we could understand, I mean, again, to make money, you got to be different and you got to be right. I think that it's not that hard, but you know, a contrarian view, or we call it, we want to be violently contrarian, and it's just way different. You know, when we're way different from the street, if there's a street consensus and we're arrogant enough to believe that we're right, you know, that's where you're really going to make your money. And so when we're at 9 and they're at 4, and we know why they're at 4, we understand why they're at 4, and we're really confident they're wrong and we're right, you know, those can be what we call core ideas. You know, those can be ideas that, you know, for us is a 5 to 10% position, the core, what we call these core ideas. And so when we're arrogant enough to believe that we're right and have that high conviction, and we don't get, you know, if, our whole model is, if you get 3 or 4 of these a year, you're going to do great. You know, if you have a 7% position that doubles, you know, you just made 7%. And if you get 2 or 3 of those, you've had a great year. And so that's kind of the model of APIS. And so for Siltronic, you know, we bought and we made it a core position. I think it, you know, it went from 40 to about 160, you know, and of course, as we talked about earlier, you know, we sold on the way up and didn't necessarily top ticket and certainly didn't bottom ticket. But all that's part of a process too of, you know, doing your work, building a position, getting more conviction, adding to the position, seeing the stars, you know, come into alignment, continuing to add to the position as it does that. And then, you know, having the pragmatism to say like, okay, you know, is this now in the price? Now several analysts are covering it, you know, and their earnings have gone from 4 to 12. And, you know, of course, now they're going to project, you know, 16 for the year after. And we're kind of nervous, you know, we no longer have an edge, you know, or maybe 16 we think is a bit too high, because these are cyclical, you know, and while they're sort of growth cyclicals, kind of stocks that I guess you rent rather than own to some degree, or you have to at least keep them on a more short, keep an eye, I guess, on the cycle itself, because that's going to drive the stock performance. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't remember exactly where we got in and where exactly we got out. And I know we didn't execute perfectly, but, I know we were out sort of back in the low hundreds, and I think it then fell again to about 60 as a share price. And of course, it's done well again in this most recent semiconductor cycle. So again, that sort of plays to our advantages. We know the Asians. We understood why the Europeans were kind of, you know, we call it the locals don't get it. You know, it's sort of one of these areas where we get value, and that sometimes they have this great situation. It's right in front of their nose, but they don't appreciate it because they can't see the bigger picture. They've never looked at semiconductor, you know, wafer stocks in the past and said, we have, you know, so we could bring that Asian perspective over to this European company and get an edge in it.
Very good. So you talked a little bit about selling on the way up. So obviously taking profits is part of your sell discipline. Mm-hmm. Are there any other elements to your sell discipline, particularly on the risk management side, when things go wrong? You know, how do you make that decision that it's time to cut bait and move on to another idea?
You know, you're always, it's, you know, what I love about this game is you're always getting feedback every day, and you know, it's like you take a test. You don't look at the ones you get right. You look at the ones you got wrong, and that's what you're going to learn from. And that's, you know, every day you see things you're getting wrong, and you're looking at that and trying to understand those reasons why you're wrong. You know, I think this is where you get into the art of investing. It's, you know, there's an element of, if I don't understand why it's not working, you know, certainly you see things and it sticks out like a sore thumb if it's not working. It's not easy to get that subset of stocks that that are giving you problems. But then you go through them name by name and try to understand, you know, what am I missing? You know, what have we got wrong? And if you can understand that and you can get comfortable with that, then, you know, those may be situations where you can be contrarian and buy. And maybe it is just, you know, a risk-off episode or a sector rotation or, you know, one of these episodic, you know, retail investors have lost their minds kind of thing, where you can really take advantage of those types of situations. But also you have to be pragmatic. I mean, this is small cap. You're going to get things wrong. You know, there's why I'm still here after 30 years is that ability to keep my humility, to understand, you know, that when you're wrong or when you can't explain, you probably, you know, and we're very incremental in what we do. It is not, you don't see us whipping it around in terms of, you know, our exposures and stocks. And when it's not working, we're starving it or we're reducing it. When it is working, you know, we're probably incrementally adding to it or feeding it, you know. So sort of feed your winners, starve your losers is sort of, you know, the approach we have. So when you're wrong, you know, that's a good reason to sell. I mean, there are times where you're just flat wrong, you know, and it's not, if you're honest with yourself, it's pretty easy to see that's a good reason to sell. You know, I think when you have better ideas, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of internal competition for capital. We have a what we call a monthly rebuy the portfolio meeting, and it's really just start with EAs on the long side. Remind me again, why do we own this? Okay, let's look at this portfolio. I've got a large position, and our price target is only so 5% upside, whereas I've got this much smaller position with 50% upside. Let's have that discussion as a team. You know, maybe we. You know, should, and again, a lot of things just happen out of inertia in a portfolio, and you just let things work. And then, you know, you need to stop at a point in time and say, okay, is this the portfolio? If I just had cash today, is this the portfolio I would want? Is this the optimal portfolio? And so there's a lot of, you know, when we come out of our monthly meeting, there are several, you know, trim positions, you know, candidates, or maybe even outright, you know, sells. If we can't push the numbers anymore and it's already at our price target, you know, we can't dream in the most optimistic scenario that this could get any better. Yeah, it can just be, you know, we have better ideas. We have ideas which have, you know, more upside that are more compelling, and there's this competition for capital. And so that can be another reason that you sell a position. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of other, it's just, yeah, you just can't push the valuation anymore. You know, you're wrong. Those are the main reasons. But I think that there's so much behavioral in all of that. You know, there's so much of, again, I think just doing it, being, I don't know, I always think being from the Midwest, we have a reputation for just having a lot of common sense and not being too full of ourselves. And so, you know, I think that plays into our strengths that, you know, we can admit when we're wrong and move on, not take it too personally.
Yeah, it's not a Masters of the Universe vibe like you sometimes get in New York or.
I mean, I always say like allocators spend way too much time on sort of intellectual IQ and what school you went to or what have you. And of course, it's all important, I suppose. But the real investment grades are, yeah, they're smart, but they also possess a lot of common sense. You know, I think the behavioral IQ is not talked about nearly enough in this business. And so, if I was an allocator, I would really want to get to the inside the head of that portfolio manager and understand them as a person and understand them behaviorally. I think that's more important, honestly, in the long run than, you know, we don't outmodel anybody else. You know, let's be honest, our models are fine, but I'm not going to say that, you know, we're better at that than other people. But we've been around the block a few times and we've learned a lot of lessons and hopefully some of those have stuck. And that's really important in the investment business.
It's funny you mentioned that because when I was a capital allocator working in superannuation or pension funds, I used to say something quite similar to the fund managers that I would speak to. And I'd make the point that in many ways, our job is the same. We're both portfolio managers. And when they look at a stock, they're looking at the the fundamental and the business and the macro exposures that that stock is giving them. Yeah, you know, for example, if it's a bank, they're looking at its net interest margins. They're looking at what's happening in the housing market in that country. And then they're looking at their portfolio and they're deciding whether they have that already in their portfolio, whether they want some more of that kind of exposure or risk, how much, et cetera. I said, I'm doing all those things except what I'm exposed to is your thinking. How you see the world and how you make decisions. And so what I'm trying to understand is your investment philosophy, your process, your thinking, your decision-making quality, and whether or not that's similar or the same or different to other managers in my portfolio, whether I need that, whether I want more of that, the risks that that brings. So it's the same process. It's just the emphasis shifts from factors affecting the company to factors affecting a manager's thinking.
Yeah. I think that's a great, you can buy a manager who has, you know, just a very, very, very high risk tolerance, who wants to invest in a very concentrated way in a, you know, particular sector. And, you know what you're going to, or you can imagine what you're going to get with that type of person. And you can invest, you know, I'm sure other people who are going to hug a benchmark and, you know, play a fiddle at the margin and you know what you're going to get in that case too. And so I hope we're somewhere in between, I guess, in terms of some of that. I think we run actually relatively low risk from a portfolio management standpoint in terms of you know, in terms of our hedge funds. We never run leverage. You know, we're always, you know, have cash, and we're certainly not pushing any envelope in terms of, you know, gross exposure or net exposure, or we want to give people a globally diversified fund and have exposure to all geographies and all sectors and be pretty balanced and have, you know, relatively, you know, maybe 60, 70 names is sort of, you know, where I have my comfort level. And I don't know if that's, you know, more or less concentrated. There's certainly people that are more concentrated and certainly people that would have more names. But yeah, you have to find the investment style that fits your personality. You know, what makes you sleep at night? And I think that was also a very early lesson in our business, is that we sometimes did things that, you know, we want to probably give you a quick example. We had a stop loss rule at Apus Capital when we first launched Apus Capital. Not something we'd ever done in our careers. It was a stupid idea, to be honest with you. But we did it because we thought, you know, allocators would like that. and of course, for, you know, after a few months, it just wasn't working. And, you know, it created all kinds of problems. And we just threw it out, you know, and we thought, well, what the hell, what were we doing? You know, why would we do that? And again, it was sort of one of these, I think, kind of immature things that we did as managers, to think that you should do something because the market wants you to do it. And you got to do what works for you. And then you've got to hopefully be able to explain that to other people, that hey, this fits my personality. This is how I'm built. This investment process works for me. It might not work for you, but it works for me. And it's my job to explain to you why it'll work, you know, over the long run and give you a good return.
Your comments remind me of a great book called What I Learned Losing $1 Million.
I can read that. I don't know that one.
It's written by a former trader on the Chicago commodity markets, and he was very successful for 25 years, and he lost everything in a three-month period on one trade.
Wow.
When I say everything, I mean everything. Life savings, money borrowed from friends. And he wrote it all the way down until the margin clerk put him out of his misery. And what happened after that is, after going through, you know, an understandable period of depression, he sat down to try and figure out where he went wrong and what he could learn from it, and write the book. And the first half of the book talks about his story. And then he gets to a point where he went and did a lot of serious study of all these different ways to make money, you know, different investment styles. And what he found was that he was getting all of this contradictory advice, in that he was reading about value investors, growth investors, momentum investors, long-term investors, short-term investors. And they were all contradicting each other except on one thing. And that was what you just said, really, is you've got to do what works for you and not lose money. You have to manage risk in a way that matches mm-hmm. your style. That was the one consistent theme across everything that he looked at, was there's lots of ways to make money, but you've got to keep it. And the only way to do that is to manage money mm-hmm. in a way that suits you and your personality and your objectives.
Right. Right. I think that book sounds sort of, I'm sure you've probably read the Market Wizards books, but those are sort of vignettes, right? Of a similar kind of, I always kind of live vicariously through these people that, like, you know, they make tens of millions and they lose it all and then they make it back. And I was like, oh my God, I could never, ever do that. You know, I couldn't possibly put myself in that kind of situation. But it is interesting to kind of, again, you know, understand the mind of some of those people, because there are other players in the market and they think differently from you, and you have to understand what's motivating them sometimes, and that's all part of the game, I guess, and understanding, you know, we look at that too when we look at businesses and we look at who are the owners of this business, and if it's if it's a value crowd, then you will generally see a behavior of that stock will sort of, you know, it tends to be low volatility. It's you know, whereas if you have the growth momentum crowd and you look at those types of players or in your name, you know, oh, okay, I can understand why this stock is behaving this way today. These are sort of some, you know, I'll say flaky characters that I've gotten in bed with. And so I can appreciate maybe why this particular security is behaving the way that it is. So yeah, it's all part of the game.
And as you're looking at the stocks in your portfolio, how are you thinking about position sizing? Obviously, it would be different across the three funds, but in broad terms.
No, in broad terms, we do have the same approach across the funds. We have this concept of farm, what we call farm, research, and core. And the idea of farm, research, and core is that, we created this, what we call farm team, because we kept finding, we used to work with these enormous watch lists, and we sort of, you know, we're big believers in terms of, you know, whoever turns over the most rocks wins, you know, that sort of Peter Lynch principle. And so just meet businesses, meet companies, learn about their industries, learn about their particular businesses. And you're just going to start to naturally kind of connect dots and start to put things together and over time. So, but what we would, again, this is a behavioral, I guess, challenge, is that what do you do with a watch list? You watch it, you know, and that, you know, like you being an allocator looking at fund managers, if you have an investment with the fund manager, I guarantee you, you're going to look more closely at that fund manager than some guy that, you know, you met once and you were curious and, you know, you probably weren't going to invest with him, but, you know, you keep tabs on him or whatever. But when you own it, suddenly, okay, I'm feeling it. And again, for our farm team is a sub 1% position, no note, no model. I'm the PM, you know, I'm the decision maker, but if our analyst could come to me and say, hey, Dan, I think this is interesting. I still have some work to do. These are some questions I have, but you know, it's timely. Let's get something started. And just based on my experience, sure, let's do 50 basis points. Let's do up to 1%. Now to grow it to the research portfolio, which is a 1-5% position, full note, full model, you know, more, at least two people on the team agree. So we got a larger consensus on the team, and we're developing, you know, it's a lot of times, and it's okay. In the farm team, you do the work and you're like, ah, you know, I found some hair on this, you know, this, it wasn't, there was something I can't get comfortable with, or it's not as, you know, I'm not building the really strong contrarian view that I had hoped I'd buy. That's okay. Kick it out. So there is this kind of churn, and maybe 10% of the portfolio is typically in the, what we call the farm team. The bulk of the portfolio isn't that 1-4, you know, percent range, maybe, you know, or 50% of the portfolio, 60% of the portfolio, where these are 1-5% positions. Again, full note, full model. We have a contrarian view. It may not be perfect. It may have liquidity or other risk constraints that sort of keep it in that 1-5 bucket. It may not be necessarily as timely, or the timing isn't necessarily perfect, but we really like it. It's a solid idea. We have edge. We have an argument with the market. We have conviction. It's gone through our diligence process. You know, that can be a research position. And then to go core, which again is sort of these, like the Siltronic example I gave you, is sort of these 5% plus positions. full note, full model, actually consensus of the team. You know, there's not, I mean, Eric, my partner at APHIS I require his agreement on anything that's going to be a corporate decision, because these are going to be the big movers. You know, these can hurt or help, hopefully help, you know, the portfolio. But we really have this, you know, like I said, we're at 9, the street's at 4. We know why they're at 4. We know why we're at 9. We're right. They're wrong. You know, we're going to make that a big position. So those are what we call our core ideas. And those, you know, those might be, you know, our top 10 positions are probably, you know, 40-50% of the fund. So at the top, these are 7-8% positions. At the bottom, they're maybe 3% positions. But, you know, those 3 or 4 or 5 core names, you know, hopefully that we have are 5-10% type positions. And in total, those 4 or 5 names might be 30-40% of the portfolio. I should say, yeah, I mean, if they average to sort of 6-7% positions, you know, if you have 5 of those, you know, that's 30% or whatever of the portfolio. So it's kind of a blend of, there is this tail of names, but there's also, you know, these core high conviction ideas that that kind of give you a little bit of that concentrated portfolio while having a kind of well-diversified, you know, tail of names as well.
And when a stock makes that core allocation, how long would you typically own it for? What would be your usual investment horizon for a well-researched core position that you've got a strong team consensus on?
Yeah, and there's a nuance to that. I mean, I can give you the mathematical answer. I think is the average holding period has been about 3.5 years for a position like that. But there is some, you know, that Siltronic was probably a 1.5 year type of position. And that was because it was a little bit more of a cyclical story. There was a moment in time where we had a lot of edge and that got closed pretty quickly. So, and that's okay. It can then go from core back to research, or, you know, even in some cases it goes back to farm, you know, because the timing isn't right, or, you know, what the thesis has largely played out, or it goes out, you know, entirely. So, you know, but the ideal is to have, you know, we've had a few of these where they've been almost for the entire existence of APHIS, you know, where we've owned a company for 15 years. You know, it's been a multi, you know, bagger over that period of time. And the goal is to, you know, find those that can do that. So I will say too, I think just as a small cap investor, you can't bet on the quarter, and, you know, you can't be short term. You actually, it's a requirement that you look out 3 to 5 years and you think, okay, this business will still be a good business in 3 to 5 years, because you don't know when you're going to get paid in that spectrum. I mean, a lot of times in small cap, you can kind of be the proverbial, you know, tree in the forest or whatever, and it's doing great. It's executing fundamentally just the way you'd hoped, and nobody cares. And nobody's paying any attention to it. But then for some mysterious reason, the spotlight maybe comes to that segment of the market, and, you know, you're like, duh, you know, where have you been all my life? You know, it's about time. And you get a very significant re-rating in a short period of time. And so I think if you're playing, you know, just because you think, hey, this is going to have a good situation short term, you know, they may have a great quarter and the stock does nothing. We're talking about the time frame for small cap investing, yes, and sort of the 3 to 5 year view. I think you just hope that somewhere along that, you know, if you have that perspective, you hope in that time frame that someone will notice what you've noticed, you know, as long as you have that longer term view. But hoping that they'll see what you see imminently is probably, you know, potentially asking for too much.
Mm-hmm. Now, we can't avoid asking the question, because we're still in the middle of this pandemic. We're trying to work our way out of it. But from the perspective of a fund manager in your portfolio, what were some of the lessons that you learned investing through this period of lockdowns and uncertainty?
You know, I think we managed the crisis, if you want to call it that, reasonably well. You know, while I felt like we were pretty prepared as much as you could be for what was about to come, because certainly you were getting signs in January, February that this was, you know, we'd seen SARS and, you know, some of these other things. And again, you know, having experience, you lived through some of those. And, you know, I pretty quickly, you know, if you'd talked to me in February of 2000, you know, it's not inconsistent with what I would have said. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, you know, and I was worried about society's reaction to it rather than really being a you know, it's obviously a horrible disease and it's become very political to talk about it, unfortunately, but it certainly affects a certain segment of the population. And it's certainly a significant risk for a certain segment of the population. But I think I understood pretty quickly that this was not a significant risk for young, healthy people. and the world was going to carry on. And certainly because, again, of the volatility, I mean, that fell off in March, April was as vicious as, you know, my first experience was the 87 crash. I mean, I got investing in 87. So that hurt too. You know, that was a horrible day. October 19th was traumatic for me. But this was sort of an elongated, you know, few week period of trauma and a crash that took place over several days. But you know, there's always these opportunities to, well, I call it upgrade your portfolio. And you get in a portfolio of stocks, you'll see two things you like equally. One, for some reason, is down 5%, and another business you feel similarly about is down 50. You know, those are great opportunities. You know, those are, and again, I don't really want to change the composition of the portfolio. I don't want to change my gross and net positioning or whip around the portfolio risk too much. But from a stock picking standpoint, as much as it pains you, you know, sell the one down 5 and use that capital to buy the one that's down 50. Those opportunities, you know, they do come to you on a semi-regular basis. You have these risk on, risk off, you know, kind of episodes. And so we treated COVID similar to that. You know, we saw businesses that were, again, just margin selling and very much panic. You know, in small cap, you get a lot of variability. There, small cap can at times be a place to hide out. Sometimes there are stocks that just, they don't really trade much, so they kind of avoid some volatility even in a volatile time. But you know, if you can get those out of the book and then use that, you know, some of the under and buy some of the underperformers, you know, we took advantage of that. But certainly, you know, we learned too. I think, like everyone, when it started, we thought, oh, everyone's going to pull in their horns and, you know, consumer spending will drop. And, you know, we were quite surprised. You know, it was pretty early in April, May, when you could start to see that actually online sales were quite strong. And, you know, everything at home, you know, and doing things at home or feathering your nest and buying furniture and you know, IT products or online gaming or gambling or, you know, things like that were actually benefiting from this, you know. And so this, you know, I think it was natural to think people will cower and be afraid, but actually their behavior was just the opposite. They went out and spent money like drunken sailors. And so we didn't, you know, and again, kind of with our style, we saw this behavior in the US and thought, well, gosh, are there online businesses in other parts of the world that are, you know, will people in France start to buy furniture? And, you know, where we found online businesses in Scandinavia, for example, that were still very much down and out, but that same behavior, and we're all human beings at the end of the day. So some of that behavior that we saw in the US was quickly translating. We're seeing it in other parts of the world. Again, you know, we have this luxury of the dollar, and we could print money and, you know, flood the markets and flood people with free money, and they didn't have to work. And, you know, so there's some crazy, crazy things that we tried. But to a lesser extent, those programs were happening all over the world. And so, you know, we found a lot of businesses that we kind of taking those lessons real quickly and applying them to other parts of the world, and found some, you know, good online e-commerce businesses and things like that that did very well in the second half of the year.
You're right. That was a big difference between the COVID sell-off and the financial crisis, was that the liquidity that central banks created during the financial crisis went largely to the banks to repair their balance sheet. But this time it went right into the pocket of consumers. And yeah, they saved a big chunk of it, but they also spent a lot of it too.
Yeah. Yeah. Americans have a reputation for pretty much living for the day. And my son, this is sort of a funny aside, he goes to Yale, so he's a smart kid, but he took a semester off, the second semester, because he became a ski lift operator at Deer Valley in Utah. So he just was tired of online learning, and that wasn't the college experience that he wanted. So he got to live in a dorm with, you know, a bunch of people, the other ski lift operators who were, you know, a little bit different. And his roommate got a stimulus check for, I don't know, you know, $700 or something like that. And immediately he bought a pair of like $700, like fur lined, you know, leather gloves. And he just, you know, and so there were a tendency for, you know, that certain types of the population to just spend it very quickly on frivolous things. And so, when you give Americans money, they don't let it stay in their pocket too long. Generally speaking,
I think some of it ended up in GameStop as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Crypto, you know, we're still seeing it, although maybe that's waning somewhat. But yeah, that's been a feature as well of the last year and a half.
So looking forward now, we're hearing a lot about supply chain disruptions. We're hearing about the Great Resignation, you know, high quit rates, people leaving their jobs. We're hearing about inflation no longer being transitory. Jay Powell told us it's possibly not transitory anymore.
Yeah.
How are you seeing that play out across, you know, the companies in your portfolio and where you're seeing opportunities?
Well, I think one of the real interesting changes that's going to take a number of years, and there's going to be a lot of investment implications, is just the onshoring of manufacturing, the re-onshoring of manufacturing. I think a lot of businesses, you know, it's been a lot of fun to kind of outsource everything and earn this incredible return on capital because you could just design a semiconductor wafer and you could have it fabricated in Taiwan and packaged in Malaysia and built in a product in China and shipped to, you know, where. So that, but, you know, we learned that just in time, and having these supply chains, which are disparate and very global, leaves your business vulnerable. And I think right now, I mean, certainly when you look at, I think it's strategic. I mean, we're way over reliant on Taiwan Semiconductor, for example. If China were to ruffle the feathers of Taiwan, we've got big, big problems. And these aren't problems that you can fix overnight. I mean, TSMC is building, I think, 9 semiconductor fabs. As of now, they're going to spend $90 billion, and most of them, I think, are in Phoenix. Intel is making a huge push into semiconductor fabrication. Samsung, of course, is also. But you can't, you know, again, you talk about moats, you know, who can do a 3-nanometer, you know, design chip? There's one company on earth that can do that. It's Taiwan Semiconductor. And there's one company that can do the EUV lithography called ASML lithography. And as far as I know, that's not going to change, you know, not in my investment horizon. And so we have become, you know, hugely dependent on a few businesses and a few companies. And that's a huge vulnerability for our existence and our world, as the world as we know it. And so, you know, what you're seeing now is, you know, an onshoring of, you know, why are we building these 9 fabs in the United States? Because having 9 fabs in Taiwan was not a very good idea. Or, you know, there's some in China as well. But so that's a strategic need, I think. And we're seeing that, you know, that's going to probably cause, you know, companies to keep inventories of things. You know, you see it in the automotive sector. You know, they're going to have to build more themselves. They're going to have to, you know, have some safety stock of various components. They don't want to get caught out the way they were caught out this time. And they don't want to be vulnerable to, you know, because if you look at the automotive IC chain, a lot of that problem was in packaging companies in Malaysia. And when COVID shut them down for a month or two, everything got stopped up, you know, and it didn't matter if you could make the semiconductors, you still couldn't package them, you still couldn't test them, you still couldn't get them to the factory in China, where maybe it went onto a printed circuit board and then got put into a product. And so, you know, shipping, you know, all those things, all that congestion that you see today, you know, I think that'll get worked out. But I am a believer on the inflation front. You know, we don't do a lot of macro at Apis. You know, I do believe that stock pickers, sometimes they get consumed by macro. And I think that's a dangerous thing when they do. So I try not, you know, we do a little bit of macro at Apis, but not a lot. But one thing I kind of kept as a truism in economics and inflation was that you couldn't have inflation without wage inflation. You know, all through my career, you'd have these bouts of, you know, little bits of inflation. The companies would have pricing power. And I would always wonder, well, is inflation coming back? And I never really saw it because I said, you know, there just isn't wage inflation. So how can you have inflation if you don't have wage inflation? And so when you say, is it different this time? You know, what is different this time is we have wage inflation. You know, we have significant wage inflation. And when you talk about the great resignation and people dropping out of the workforce, and you can't automate everything, you know, and you know, we're seeing tremendous pricing power of wages in the US, you know, some especially, you know, which is probably not altogether unhealthy, more on the lower end of the wage brackets, where people who made $10 an hour are now making $15. Restaurants in Minneapolis, you know, start at $18 an hour, which is not bad if you, you know, work 40 hours a week and 52 weeks a year. It's an okay living. So, and that's for a fast food company. You know, you can do higher value added things than that as well. So, that job used to be a $8-$9 an hour job, you know, that's literally doubled in the last year. So, you know, we are seeing wage inflation. I think that's sticky. I think you see it in rents, you see it in other things that are sticky, that don't typically come down once they've gone up. And so I think that means cost of capital is higher. I think discount rates eventually should go higher. It probably argues that valuations should go lower at some stage. You know, and some of the speculation and more speculative areas of the market, you know, probably will need to come back, but timing is everything.
Well, Dan, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about your career and Apis and your portfolio and how you're seeing the markets. Thank you very much for joining us on the Foresight Active Investment Podcast.
Absolutely. It was fun. Nice to talk to you.